If you want to change your life, first you have to change the way you think, not the history. But they don't take it as an excuse for being not successful. And I think this is the same with people as it is with nations.
Look at a time of unparalleled global prosperity. Yet globally, 1 in 10 people still live in poverty. It need not be this way. The experience over recent decades, from Poland to Vietnam, shows that hundreds of millions more people can be lifted out of poverty. Through development aid, perhaps not, but rather through embracing markets development. Welcome back to the IEA podcast. My name is Matt Flesh, and I'm the IEA's Director of Public Policy Communications. Each week, this podcast asks a tantalizing policy question. Today's question, how do nations escape poverty? To discuss, I'm very excited to be joined for the first time on the podcast by Rainer Zittelmann. He's the author, historian, sociologist, and management consultant. He's the author of several books, but perhaps most recently, what we'll be talking about today is his recent book, How Nations Escape Poverty. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with this broad question from your studies. What do you think are the key ingredients of escaping poverty?
I think, first of all, it's important to understand how nations do not escape poverty, what is not the solution for poverty. Because a lot of people think that development aid is the key. They believe in what I call the zero-sum thinking, zero-sum belief. They believe that rich people are rich because they took away from the poor. And so they think also that poor nations are poor because rich nations took something away from them. And so the solution is, of course, they should give back something and with development aid. And the first thing that I show in my book, based on a lot of scientific studies, that development aid does not help anything. In the best case, the result is nothing, but in a lot of cases, it's even worse than nothing because it even hurts the countries that receive this development aid. So I think this is the first most important thing that, and to have it more in general, it's not possible to export something like whether it's democracy or whether it's the market economy. You know, the United States, they tried very often to export democracy.
Nation building.
Yes, but in most cases, it did not work. It didn't work in Africa. It didn't work in a lot of Asian countries. And to have it in more general, you should compare Africa on the one hand and Asia on the other hand. Africa is still the poorest continent in the world by far. And it did something changed in some countries, but not so much. If you compare it with Asia, on the other hand, we have a lot of countries that escape poverty. China, for example, where in the beginning of the 80s, 88% of the population lived in extreme poverty. Today, it's less than 1%. South Korea, that was one of the poorest countries in the world, poorer than all African countries. And now it's a wealthy nation. And so in Asia, we have some success stories. Later, we will talk about Vietnam. But in Africa, Africa received much, much more development aid than Asia. And so even if you compare only these two cases, Africa with a lot of development aid, it's nothing changed, but not much. And Asia, on the other hand, where a lot of countries escape poverty, then you see, if you compare this, that development aid can't be the solution.
You made a quite interesting point in that chapter in the book that stuck with me, which is that what drives a lot of the idea behind development aid is the sense that the world is zero sum, that we got rich because we took from other parts of the world, And we now have a responsibility to give back. And if you understand the world as a fixed pie that we're just slicing up in different ways, I guess that's true. But I suppose the great advantage of market systems and the great advantage of actually enabling economic growth is that everyone can get rich. It's not a contradiction in terms to say they can get richer in Asia, in Africa, whilst Europe and the US get richer as well. I mean, they might get richer a bit. Their economic growth might be faster because they've got more to catch up on. It might be hard for them to get to exactly the same level straight away. But as long as you can get in place the right framework, institutional framework, I guess, it will grow.
The zero-sum thinking, of course, is absolute nonsense. And I give only one example. I spoke about China. In the end of the 50s, 45 million people died in China as a result of the biggest socialist experiment in history, Mao Zedong's so-called Great Leap Forward. Even in 1981, I mentioned this number, 88% lived in extreme poverty. Today it's less than 1%. But at the same time, the number of billionaires increased. In Mao's time, there was not a single billionaire. Today you have as many billionaires in China as in the United States, or only a few more in the United States than in China. So if zero-sum thinking would be correct, you couldn't explain it. If rich people become rich because they take it away from the poor, how can it happen that on one hand, the number of people living in poverty decreases, at the same time, the number of billionaire increases? So this is not logical. It's not only for China, it's worldwide. 200 years ago, 90% of the worldwide population lived in extreme poverty. Today, it's less than 9%. And at the same time, we have now much, much more wealthy people. Even in the 80s, 43% of the worldwide population lived in extreme poverty, 43%. And the number of billionaires was, in 2000, it was only 500. Today, it's 2,700. So if at the same time the number of billionaires increases and the number of people living in poverty decreases, you see that zero-sum thinking is absolute nonsense.
Yeah, so it's the same thinking that drives their obsession with inequality. So if you can understand everyone's getting richer, the gaps between them don't matter as much. But if you think it's just a fixed pie, then it does matter, again, to think about inequality more. I'm interested, your latest book, How to Escape Poverty, really focuses in on two specific countries that probably aren't quite talked about as much when it comes to economic development. We've heard a lot about China in recent years, but you've chosen to write about Vietnam and Poland. I was wondering why you chose to do a laser focus on those particular countries.
There are several reasons. So the first reason, I looked at the Index of Economic Freedom from the Heritage Foundation to find out which countries had the highest increase in economic freedom since they started the index. They started the index in 1995. And if you compare all these countries, these are about 180 countries, and if you look which countries had the highest increase in economic freedom, then there are two countries. It's Vietnam and Poland. There are some very small countries or smaller countries that with even a bigger increase, but from the comparable countries with a comparable population or size, there's no country. By the way, a lot of people don't know how many people live in Vietnam because I've been there often and I speak with people and sometimes I ask people, what do you guess how many people live there in Vietnam? And most of the people say, oh, 20 million, 30 million. No, it's wrong. It's 100 million. It's bigger than any European country. It's bigger than Germany, for example. A lot of people don't know this. And so if I speak about, and Poland is 40 million. And so if I speak about bigger countries, I saw it first in the Index of Economic Freedom. This is striking that they have the biggest increase in economic freedom. And then I admit there's also a personal reason because the two longest relationships with girls I had in my life, the one was from Poland, the other was from Vietnam. So the parents, and so I have a kind of, you know, sort of personal relationship. I've been there in these countries, and so I know something about the mentality in these countries. And so I started to talk with people there and to read then about history, the economic history of these countries. And I found out that these countries have a lot in common. That was also a surprise for me. Not only that there are a lot of beautiful women, this is one thing, but also that, first from the history, both countries were involved in terrible wars. Of course, we know the Vietnam War with the United States. Everyone knows about this. But what a lot of people don't know, that before this war, they had a war with France, and they had a war with Japan, and with the United States, and with China. So they were at war with almost not everyone. But I remember I had a conversation with an ambassador from Vietnam, and I mentioned that I like it in the Vietnamese people that they are very positive to the United States, in spite of the fact that they could be angry because of the war. And he said, okay, but we were at war with half of the members of the United States Security Council, and if he would be angry with every one of them, it makes no sense. So this was the war in Vietnam. And in Poland, of course, Poland was the first victim of Adolf Hitler and Stalin. And what a lot of people don't know, Poland lost more people than any other country in the Second World War, adjusted to the population. Of course, not in absolute numbers, but adjusted. So first they had this terrible war. Then another thing they had in common, after the war, there was a planned economy in Poland and in Vietnam. And Vietnam was the poorest country in the world in 1990. It's really the poorest country, even poorer than Sierra Leone.
Let's come to Vietnam, and then we'll come back to Poland shortly. So yeah, I was wondering, you described, quite well in the book, what life was like prior to the reforms, prior to not really that long ago, about just over 30 years ago.
Yes, I conducted, I did two things. First, I commissioned a poll in Vietnam, a representative poll, where I can talk about the results, how people think about capitalism and the market economy, and how they think about rich people. But the other thing, I had a couple of interviews, personal interviews about their daily life. And it was really, poverty meant something totally different than what we think when we think about poverty. They had not enough to eat. They had hunger. In a lot of cases, the money that they earned was only enough for maybe the first week for the month. And so even in Hanoi, what is the capital of Vietnam today, a lot of people had a peak in their, say, if they had two rooms, one room, maybe a small room for 8 or 9 people, and the other room for to raise a peak, because it was the only possibility to have something to eat or to make some money. And it meant, I have it in my book, that people had to stand in queues, in lines, to get even a handful of rice for hours and hours, sometimes even for days. They had to wait. Young children, 10-12-year-old children, who had to stand hours and hours only to get a little bit, a handful of rice. And in this time, they didn't produce enough rice. They had even to import it. Today, it's one of the biggest rice exporters in the world, but not only rice, also for smartphones and semiconductors and high tech. So it changed a lot. And this was the daily life. If I should talk about numbers, the GDP per capita in Vietnam in 1990 was $98. And even in Sierra Leone, it was $130. So it was...
Where is it today?
What?
Where is Vietnam at today to compare?
I can say it in today's numbers, but if I compare for this time, you see, it was really poorer than all African countries.
Mm. So how did Vietnam then go down the path of reform? It was quite a socialist country, and it wasn't directly controlled in the way that Soviet Union controlled Poland. It was pretty much able to control its own destiny. Why was there this instigation towards market reform?
Of course, first they tried what they try in all socialist countries, to reform socialism, to make it work better. This is not only in Vietnam, but this happened in almost all socialist countries. Then when they saw that it does not work, they tried to make reforms, but inside the system. But they did not work. And then there was a party congress in 1986. And then they started with these reforms. They had a discussion inside the party. They were, as always, more conservative parts of the party, and the more people who wanted to reform the system. And they had the majority then, and then they started the reforms. But what is very important to understand, the reforms started, or the changes started, even before as a grassroots movement from the peasants. You have to know, at this time, almost everyone was lived in rural areas that were peasants. And what they did after they won the war with this crazy collectivization, what they did before in the Soviet Union and in China, it failed everywhere. There's not a single example from any country where it worked. And so, of course, did not work in Vietnam. Then something similar happened to China. In China, even before Deng Xiaoping's reforms, there started a grassroots movement from not from the top down, but, you know, a grassroots movement from peasants who started to take again their own land and to reverse this process of collectivization. And this worked. And what the party did in the first part with their reforms was mostly to legalize things that had happened anywhere. And this is very important.
From a system where more or less people own the agriculture, own the land collectively, they farm, they're expected to farm, but they only get back a set amount. So if they work harder, if they produce more, they get no reward for it. Inevitably, the result is starvation, which is there's not enough food produced. And what you're describing here is just on the very local level, people chose and cooperated with each other, where they would let themselves basically keep what they produced and have a kind of semi very local market system.
Absolutely. And by the way, it's important. In all socialist countries, the peasants were allowed to own maybe, for example, 5% of their land for themselves. But in most cases, 80% of the production was only this 5% of the land that they owned. And the other 20% in the 95% that was owned by the people, as they told it.
So it started off with this kind of liberalization of agriculture. What was next? What were the next elements of the reforms?
Sure. Then they started with that they allowed private property, that it was possible then to build your own company. Before, it was only allowed to have not more than seven people who work for private owners. And then it was private property was allowed. And the next very important thing, they opened the economy for foreign investors. This was especially very important in Vietnam. And they understood that foreign investors are not their enemies, but that it will help them to open the economy. And they did it to about now over the years to a degree as no other country in this region. They have now more free trade agreements with other countries than every other country in South Asia. So they embraced foreign investors. They also started with privatization of some state-owned companies. But to be honest, there's a lot of things to do. There are still too many state-owned companies today in Vietnam. They have to do there much more.
So what was the result of all this reforms? Where is Vietnam today economically?
This is great. I think the most important thing is if you look for the number of people living in poverty in 1990, 80% of the people in Vietnam lived in poverty. Today, it's less than 5%. I think this is the most amazing thing, from 80% to 5%. And wow. If you go there to Vietnam, you see a very entrepreneurial spirit. I think this is very important to understand what happened there. It's important to understand that they changed also their mindset. For example, how they see rich people, how they see the market economy. We had, I was invited to lectures at universities in Vietnam, and I was invited, for example, to the Foreign Trade University, and the topic of the workshop was, how can we improve the image of wealthy people? I've invited to a lot of lectures at universities in Europe and in the United States, but no university invited me for a workshop, how can we improve the image of wealthy people? But this was what it important for them, though. They call themselves today a socialist country with a leading communist party, but I can guarantee you that it's much easier to find a Marxist at a university in Europe or in the UK or the United States than in Vietnam. It's much easier. So
Let's have a bit of a chat about Poland now then, and then we can come back and discuss some of the survey results that you found as well. So life in Poland, I suppose, almost comparable in some ways to life in Vietnam. I mean, certainly you kind of look quite closely at the issue of rationing and rationing cards and how long the farce of having to line up for days and days. Now, of course, Poland wasn't quite as poor as Vietnam, but nor was it a wealthy country by any stretch.
No, absolutely. What a lot of people don't know, Poland was even poorer than the Ukraine at this time, and the GDP per capita was only half of the Czech Republic. So even if you compare them with other socialist countries, they were extreme poorer. And if you compare them with West Germany, they had only... they earned only 10%, like $50 the month. And even if you're corrected for purchasing power, people in Germany earned three times more this time. So it was one of the poorest countries in Europe, as you mentioned, of course, not as poor as Vietnam. But if you compare it with other European countries, it was really one of the poorest countries. And they started with the same thing as they did in Vietnam and a lot of other countries, with reforms inside the system to improve socialism, to implant some elements of the market economy inside the system. But then there was one economist, his name is Leszek Balcerowicz. He became Fidesz prime minister and Minister for Finance in Poland, and he was, I call him the Maggie Thatcher of Poland, or the Ronald Reagan of Poland. I don't know why. Everyone knows Maggie Thatcher or Ronald Reagan, but there are not so many people who know his name, Balcerowicz. But what he did was amazing. He was a professor for economy, and he believed in the teachings of Ludwig von Mises and Hayek, and he said... Mises convinced him that the only way to reform socialism is to abolish socialism and to implement capitalism. And this is exactly what he did in 1990.
So in the Polish case, you describe it as quite rapid. I guess a critic might even say is shock therapy.
Yes.
But you think that that was kind of necessary, that it happened, it had to happen quickly, otherwise it might not have happened at all, even though in the years immediately after the end of socialism, there was a big economic decline in Poland. Overall, you think it was for the best?
Yes, and I think the reason is the difference. You know, Vietnam is still today a one-party system. It's not a democracy. But the difference between countries is that they had also the change in politics, that the workers' movement and the unions, that they abolished the so-called paradise for workers, as they called socialism, but it was workers who destroyed the system. But then there was a democracy, and in a democracy, it's in a way harder to implement these reforms, because what you have to understand, if you start with these free market reforms, first for a year, 2 years, or maybe even for a longer period, things become worse. For example, the hidden unemployment becomes open unemployment. And they had a lot of companies went bankrupt because they were not longer competitive with other Western companies. And so, but if this happens, of course, in the same time, the media will write about, oh, it doesn't work. You see, his crazy ideas with capitalism, we have to go back to more government. And of course, all the other parties, the opposition, will say, you see, it doesn't work. In Vietnam, they did not have this problem, so they could take a longer time. Of course, they had also, it's not so that in a party that is a one-party system, that they cannot ignore what people think and feel. But of course, it's a difference whether there's a free press and other parties. And so he had, this was, I think, the main reason why he had to do it in this fast way with this shock therapy. And even it took 2 years before the situation became better. But the good thing is that some things even improved earlier. For example, there was a headline in the newspaper one day that eggs become cheaper. This was, for example, news. So people saw, and what happened, of course, on the one hand, everything became much more expensive because they abolished the price controls. But on the other hand, now there were full shelves. Before, there were only empty shelves. And even with money, you could buy, even with your money and with your ration cards, sometimes you could buy nothing. So some things changed. And yes, this is a shock therapy. And I'm curious whether the strategy of Javier Milei now in Argentina will work the same way, because he tries it the same way. And I see some parallels between both, between Bolsonaro on the one hand and Javier Milei on the other hand. From their personality, they are completely different. So, you know, from the personality, Milei is more like Trump or Bolsonaro, always shouting and very aggressive. And Bolsonaro, I met him, it's much more like a typical professor for economic, not very emotional.
I mean, yeah, it's an interesting case. I think with Milei, there's been some reporting recently that he's struggling to get the reforms through Congress. So although he's tried to propose a lot, he might struggle. But I think that might be a topic for another podcast at another time. Yes. I mean, what I find quite fascinating about Poland, and actually it's, I don't know whether you've seen this, it gets talked about quite a lot recently in the UK, because people make the point, including the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, recently, that Poland is going so fast at such a good pace compared to the UK that it would be a big economy than the UK by 2030. Now, it's possible, of course, Poland won't keep growing at that pace and the UK could grow a bit faster. But it is quite striking there that over the last recent decades, Poland has really grown so aggressively. And it kind of struck me. So I unfortunately haven't been to Vietnam, but I have been to Poland several times. I was in Warsaw a couple of years ago. And I got the sense of a place that is kind of new, shiny, thriving, entrepreneurial. And I know what you mean. It's kind of, it's almost hard to put your finger on it as a factual basis, but in terms of a sense you get from it. I think a part of that might be, and you've identified this in your polling, is just the attitude to entrepreneurialism, to people becoming rich, to capitalism, broadly speaking, is quite positive, not only in Poland and Vietnam, and much more positive in Poland and Vietnam than the likes of the UK or Germany.
Yes, I commissioned two different polls. The first poll is about the image of the market economy and the image of capitalism. And we did this poll now with Ipsos Mori in London, in 35 different countries. I think in the book I have 34 countries. And we asked people what they think about the market economy and what they think about capitalism. First, we asked them some questions where we didn't use the word capitalism because for a lot of people, the word capitalism has a negative connotation. And we wanted to find out how much has it to do with the word and how much what the word stands for. But whether you use the word or not, Poland was the champion from all 35 countries. Now, the most pro-free market economy attitude or pro-capitalism was in Poland, even more than in the United States or South Korea or Japan. This was really amazing. And then we had another poll about the image of rich people the question how envious people in different countries are against rich people. And the interesting thing is that we calculated something that I call it the social envy coefficient to compare different countries, how envious people are. And the most envious people are not in Germany, what I expected, no, but we are number two, but number one was, or number one is France. So in France, the people are, they are the most envious people with the most negative attitude towards rich people, by the way. Also very negative attitude towards capitalism. But in Poland and Vietnam, the attitude towards rich people is very, very positive. So this is, for example, we asked questions. So we presented them a list with personality traits. So positive and negative personality traits like intelligent or industrious or ruthless and greedy. And we asked, what do you think, what is more about true for rich people, how they are? And in Poland, it was all the personality traits that they mentioned were positive personality traits. So in Poland and Vietnam, they have a positive attitude towards wealth and rich. And I think this is important because if you see rich people, as we do it in Germany or France, as scapegoats to blame them for all negative developments, or whether you see rich people who are in most cases successful entrepreneurs as role models, of course, this makes a big difference. And in Vietnam, rich people are role models. Almost everyone want to be rich and they admire rich people. They see them very positive. And this is the difference to, of course, a lot of European countries.
What do you think the causal mechanism is there? So I think they're absolutely fascinating results. You're right in terms of these kind of very positive attitudes to rich people, to capitalism as a concept, and countries being richer. How do you think that? What in the kind of like practical link is then to why these countries have managed to not only in Poland's case escape poverty but become quite rich, and Vietnam's case be a very much a middle income, up and coming developing country. Now, people will, of course, in both cases point to other factors. You know, they'll say, oh, Vietnam's nearby to China and Poland's nearby to the EU and it's part of the EU system, and that's helped as well a lot. So, I mean, there's obviously other things going on as well. But I'm wondering what you think really links this together.
But By the way, I hear this very often. Oh, Poland, they got a lot of money from the European Union. This reason, I don't believe it. I think if there are a lot of examples in history, you can give as much money as you want to another country. If they don't have the right economic system and the right spirit, money helps nothing. Or if they have it, it can help something. But I think it's much overestimated. No, I think this mindset is very important. And you had the same thing in China. Do you know what the slogan was from Deng Xiaoping when he started his economic reforms? His slogan was, let some people become rich. And he said, in the moment when you allow people to become rich and when you see it positive, then everything will change. And this is also what happens in Vietnam. By the way, what was also very... Yes, and there are also cultural reasons. I think if you ask the question why people in Vietnam are so successful today, I spoke before that they don't blame other countries for their situation. And I think this is... And they don't look in the past. Of course, they talk about the war and they have this museum about the war. It's not that they ignore their history, but they don't take it as an excuse for being not successful. And I think this is the same with people as it is with nations. If you want to change your life, first you have to change the way you think, because what you are now and your situation, your economic situation and your health and everything else is a result how you thought in the last 10 years. And the situation in 10 years will be a result how you think today. And this is exactly for an individual as it is for a country. And I think this is so important for the people in Vietnam that they didn't blame other countries. I met a young female entrepreneur in Vietnam. She was very successful. She founded a lot of companies. By the way, you have a lot of very successful women in Vietnam, and without any kind of feminism, there's not any kind of feminism or something like this. No, but they play a very important role, and this was one of them. And she told me, my parents told me, think like an American, dress like American, eat like American, think like American, and then you will be successful. It was a surprise for me, because I think they would have a lot of reasons to be very angry against the United States. I was also surprised about the numbers in Vietnam. There were 10 times more explosives and bombs from the United States than in Germany in the Second World War. 10 times more. So, and a lot of people were killed and almost everything were destroyed. So they could have a reason to be angry against the United States and to blame them for their situation. And so if you ask what is the lessons that other countries can learn, first, capitalism is important. Free market economy. Get rid of this socialist ideas about this regulation. Open your economy. But the other important thing is the mindset, the spirit. Why was America one of the most successful, or maybe the most successful country? Of course, first because of capitalism, but then there's another thing. It is the way how they thought in America, this way of positive thinking, make things happen, make things possible. And, the attitude of people like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who came from Austria to the United States and made his way there. And I think it's a combination of both. It's the economic structure, but also the way how people think. And I think this is very often underestimated by economists. If you only look about the economic structure and the numbers, no, this is important, but the mindset and the attitude of people is also important. This is the reason why I commissioned all this polls. And only to add this, you can even predict what will happen in a country when you do this polls. I mentioned this poll in 35 countries, and some people thought the poll has to be incorrect, because one of the results was that people in Chile are more anti-capitalist than people in Argentina. And I did it 1.5 years ago, and they said, oh, you see, this poll, I think there's something wrong. Everyone knows that, that Chile is a capitalist country, and that in Argentina, they're all parodists. But what happened 3 months after the poll, they voted for a socialist in Chile, and 1.5 years after the poll, they voted for anarcho-capitalist in Argentina. So, you can predict something.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, so I suppose the key message there is, one, the absolute kind of essential importance of free market institutions, and two, the attitudes that people have and the kind of entrepreneurial spirit that exists. Unfortunately, we're very much come or even run over our usual time. So, Renna Zunderman, thank you so much for joining the IA podcast. It's been an absolutely fascinating discussion. For those who are interested in your new book, which really focuses in on Vietnam and Poland, has recently been translated to English. You can look it up, How Nations Escape Poverty. If you are enjoying the IA podcast, please do subscribe in your chosen podcast provider. And if you'd like to learn more about the IA, just visit iea.org.uk.